Welcome to the Film Experience. This is Nathaniel, and I'm here with Nick Davis
Hello.
and Joe Reed.
Hello.
And this season is off to a slow start, but we're back.
Finally, we are out, some of us back from farther away than others.
Yes, I'm just back from the National Critics Institute, which is at the O'Neill Theater Center every summer, and it was really great.
What did you
So
end up doing there?
It's basically a writing workshop, but you are given assignments every day, and like you go see a bunch of shows, and you all review the same show, and then your review sort of picked apart in a nice way. But it's very helpful because you realize that you say things and that maybe you didn't exactly mean in your review. It gets you to think really hard about your word choices.
Okay, cool.
And like the structure of your writing, like I had some line about, this thing earns our tears. And the mentor, he was like, "Okay, Nathaniel, did you cry?" And I was like, "No." And so everybody started laughing. And I was like, "But I was crying on the inside." He's like, "Then it did not earn your tear."
I kind of do like to know when people cry on the inside.
Should I have said that it earns your tears on the
That conveys
inside?
something to me, you know. It earns your internal weeping. Yeah. Yeah, right. Mostly reviewed theater, but sometimes other genres, right?
Yeah, it was mostly theater, and then we had one film and one restaurant. Occasionally, we had like some random assignments. Like we had to do like a radio spot, which was an interesting challenge and made me think of how bad I probably am at podcasting. Hooray! Thanks for listening, everyone. And then Mark Blankenship was a friend of Joe's, and he's been on our SmackDown before, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly.
Oh, he was there?
Yeah, he did a little thing about like hot takes. So,
Oh, very cool.
so his assignment was one of the most interesting because it was like write about whatever you're feeling passionate about at the moment, make an argument for something.
Yeah.
And so those were a lot more fun to workshop because it wasn't really repetitive. People weren't talking about the
Yeah.
same thing at all,
What topic about actresses did you choose? I wrote about White Oleander.
because it's very relevant to the now.
Never lost your mind, yeah.
I actually wrote about color desaturation in action movies.
Oh, there's a topic. Way to keep people guessing.
Yeah.
What was the movie you wrote about?
Well, I use Wonder Woman as the framing device for its reverse Wizard of Oz. It starts out super colorful
Yeah.
and then grays down.
Yeah.
Anyway,
That all sounds fun,
it was a
though.
great experience, and anybody who is a critic listening, I recommend applying. It
Yeah.
was a really great experience, and something you would never get a chance to do. 2 weeks where you're only
Right.
focused on your writing with other writers, and
That's awesome.
yeah. So.
Joe and I still fly coach, everybody, so not everyone's changed on you. It's safe here.
Speaking of
So good.
flying coach, did you guys watch the Actress Roundtable, the Emmy drama
I
roundtable?
haven't seen the drama one yet. I've been waiting for them to show up. I've got the DVR to record them when they show up on Sundance Channel so I can watch them on my television and only watch the comedy one, which was really good, but
Yeah,
I haven't got.
I haven't watched that one yet because I always preference drama first, but there's a really funny bit in that Chrissy Metz, or Mites, I'm not sure how to say her name, from This Is Us.
Yeah.
She was talking about, like the challenges of being a large woman in Hollywood, and she was talking about, or and just in general.
Yeah.
And so she was talking about the looks people give you on planes, and she that was a really funny story because it was combined with her story of how much her life has changed on This Is Us. So she's like, the
Yeah.
last time she got on a plane, this guy eyed her like, "Oh no, you're sitting next to me." And she's like, "Dude, relax. We're in first class. You have plenty of room." But it was just funny because she had been talking about she had 81 cents to her name before the show.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow. God, good for her.
Yeah. Or 81 cents in her bank account the day she auditioned for the show was the actual
And then
story.
It was just her and then a bunch of Oscar nominees, right? On that panel. Like they basically brought out all the heavy hitters.
Yep.
Yeah.
But I highly recommend watching because there's lots of Jessica Lange and Nicole Kidman moments for y'all.
Yeah.
It's top on my watch later.
Yeah.
Later could be today.
So speaking...
Boy, that's a mantra. Later could be today. That's
sort of... Later could be today.
Life like that, yes.
So,
would you say the conversation earned your tears?
I'm not even crying on the inside. I'm so happy to talk to you guys right now.
Well, you know, joy crying.
Other than that, I've been trying to catch up and doing, not so great of a job at it because I still haven't seen A Ghost Story or Lady Macbeth. So hopefully we will discuss them next time, but I believe you've both seen them.
Yes.
And you recommend, so we should discuss next time.
Yes, we definitely should.
Okay. And otherwise, let's backtrack to the earliest thing that we need to talk about that opened that we haven't talked about yet. The Big Sick.
White Lander.
That's always worth talking about.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of White Oleander, did you guys hear the new Michelle Pfeiffer news?
Wait, what?
The Refeifel, I'm telling you, it is not even... It's barely begun.
Yes.
Because now she was just announced as being Janet Van Dyne in Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Yeah, which I was so shocked to learn. I sort of had to rush to IMDb to make sure that she and Michael Douglas have never been in a movie together, considering they were both, like... such big stars at the same time.
Yeah. And because he had a habit of working with, like, A-list actresses in a way that a lot of A-list male actors don't.
Yeah, yeah.
He was often paired with the most famous actresses.
I assumed I would, like, go to IMDb and look it up and there would be something, you know, Russia House-esque that would, you know, have starred the both of them and I had forgotten, but no.
Russia House-esque. That's such a small category.
It's a very small category.
So in addition to all of these movies this year, her second superhero movie. Or third, if you count White Oleander.
Yes, which we do, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, what was the first?
Great Work Begins.
The first was Batman Returns.
Oh, joy. I never even think of that as a superhero movie. I always sort of... The Michelle Pfeiffer character piece, right?
Like, exactly, exactly.
Oh,
so The Big Sick.
Oh, that's the movie that's... God, that's so funny that, like, we haven't talked about that. Because it really does feel like that movie came out, like, 6 months ago.
Yeah, it's been a slow burn.
Yeah.
But speaking of superheroines, Holly Hunter.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. She's great. She's so great in that. It's one of those movies where I started off... I think I saw the trailer, and I was like, oh, God, like, Holly Hunter seems like she has such a small role on that. And then you see the movie, and it's just like, oh, no, that, like, that movie really pivots to a place where, and I think pivots in the more interesting direction, in that, just from a performance standpoint, where, like, oh, we get more of Holly Hunter and Ray Romano and less of Zoe Kazan, who's not really doing a whole lot of interesting things for my money. I thought it was really good. I thought the movie itself was... really sort of like funny and sort of that good kind of like expected heartfelt. But yeah, Holly Hunter was great.
Mm-hmm. And Nick, you saw that too, right?
Yeah, I liked it. With a lot of Judd Apatow things or things he even touches, you know, like while I'm there, I really like that it's kind of loose and baggy and roomy and like is probably taking on what you could call too many people or too much.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I see that about them. And then like as I'm, you know, later is when I start being like, well, that could have been a little tighter. Just because I realize which parts of the movie I'm not thinking about at all anymore. But I loved his interactions with the parents. I thought those were really great.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part towards the end where you're just like, all right, we're going to start the wrap up now soon, right? Where it's like, and right. That's sort of start remembering, oh, right, this is a Judd Apatow movie. Like, we are going to sort of like just
keep going. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, and returning to crying on the inside, that moment where Holly Hunter touches his face, I thought it was going to die.
Oh. Yeah.
It was just such a gesture in a movie.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it made
a lot of sort of small choices that I really liked, and a lot of decisions to sort of linger with certain characters that I liked. I liked that we got that scene with the one girl who his parents, well, one of the many girls that his parents are trying to set him up with,
but yep.
The one sort of like presents the best, and he sort of walks her home, and she wants to go on another date, and he doesn't want to, and she kind of, it's a tricky little line to write, because if she gets too righteous, then all of a sudden he's a little more sympathetic than he should be, because she's getting angry at him for, you know, something that's not under his control. But I think she makes a great case for herself, you know, in that, like, you know, hey, like, I'm a person too. I'm going through my own shit here too. While you have your story, I have my story. And I love little moments like that where you realize that there are just, like, little movies happening mm-hmm. all over the place. And that actress I really love, she's on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend playing a completely different, like, night and day kind of a character.
Oh, yes, Vella Lovell.
Yeah, she plays Heather on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and she's so funny. And she really nails this sort of, like, quietly dramatic, sort of, like, serial comic scene. It's really great.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree, and I had her in my nominee list from the 17 favorite actresses of the past 3 months.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Because, of course, I make lists like that every 3 months.
I love it. I love making lists like that. It's great.
I hate it. Does it feel to you, like, by natural inclination, a limited series? Like, as much as I liked it, and even the kind of bittiness of it did make me feel like it was still coming from a place that was mostly TV.
Oh, that scene?
No, in general, the movie.
Yeah, no, I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a pedestrian movie, especially in the filmmaking ways. But I was thinking about that Vella Lovell scene in what you're talking about, Nick, with like the anything Apatow is even vaguely connected to it, that roominess and the meandering qualities.
Yeah,
sometimes they really pay off, and you get a scene like that.
Oh, and, totally.
And
yeah.
Then other times it's just like, why are we here?
I think if it were a television series, I would probably end up losing interest in that, like, they would have to stretch out. Like, already it feels like it's stretched out, the part where Emily is in a coma for so long. And they sort of, I can't quite tell whether I feel like I was a little dissatisfied by the way that they handled her coming out of it, or whether I just didn't like Zoe Kazan's performance very much. But there was, I think, as with most romantic comedies, I would have been happier had it ended with them not together. I sort of always want my romantic comedies to end on these bittersweet notes of like, well, we couldn't make it happen. Because I feel like there's something sort of interesting when she... do we care that I'm going full on into spoilers here? Like, does that matter?
It had 6 months.
Yeah.
And also it's not a really true story, and everybody knows they got married.
Yeah. So when she comes out of it, and she's sort of like very kind of ambivalent about things, and I was like, oh, this is a really interesting choice, because of course all these things were happening and she wasn't privy to them. And again, you know, everybody's living their own movie, and for her part of that movie she was not in the theater. So I thought that was interesting, and then to sort of have to, you know, turn that ship around real slowly to get to a point where she sort of, you know, can step into that comedy club at the end. Mm-hmm. And I was, oh my God, no, it's like, it's so much more interesting, especially because as she comes out and Zoe Kazan's playing it, I'm just like, why? Like, ugh, just like hang out with her parents sometime and like whatever, like leave her to do her own thing. She's kind of a pill. But I don't know. If I had any sort of like little like nagging thing, it was maybe that.
Mm-hmm. If I have a nagging thing, and I feel terrible bringing this up because it's his story, and I appreciate how like vulnerable it is to like make your give yourself a star role that is your story for something so intimate. But I kind of felt like Kumail's performance was a little vague.
Yeah.
Especially in like close-ups, I was like, can you give me a little bit of what you're feeling as opposed to just like shell-shocked by the experience. Like, and I feel weird complaining about it because it is his story and it wouldn't exist at all without him.
Yeah, there's definitely element of having to like create your own space in the, you know, in the Hollywood ecosystem, and that, you know, great for him that he did that.
Exactly, yeah, and I'm so glad he made the movie and got to star in it and all that. I just like there's a lot of close-ups of him where I just he's like not telling me anything about the character. I felt.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, okay. Which about the character, about himself?
Yeah.
So maybe it was like that thing about maybe this is just too vulnerable, like because it is really like an intense situation to be in.
Yeah.
And then the flip side of that is, like, it was nice to see that Ray Romano was actually so good at doing that. Like, I can't remember seeing him in a movie where he wasn't playing, like, a squirrel with a nut. And I thought he was...
White Oleander.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
No.
Oh, okay.
I was saying his cameo in White Oleander as a squirrel.
Yeah, I thought he was wonderful.
Yeah, and as somebody who's actually kind of trying not to give you information,
yeah,
he was still so watchable and so interesting.
He's sort of been sort of slowly inching towards this place on television where it was a couple shows I didn't watch, but he was in a show called Men of a Certain Age, and then he was on that HBO show Vinyl that was so ill-fated, but I think on both of them, I remember hearing really, really good things about him in particular and how he sort of was advancing his comedic sort of range in a way that was really interesting, and you can see it in this movie for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I hope people are seeing it. I feel like it's not taking off exactly the way the distributor most hoped, but it's doing really solidly, right?
Yeah.
I think it's doing really good indie business, right? That's sort of what I keep hearing.
Yeah, yeah, it's a modest, from my understanding, it's a modest success, but I think they were hoping for a little bit more of, like, sleeper sensation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's rough to say it, but it's just sort of like there's no space for that right now. Do you know what I mean?
You mean in movies in general?
I think in just, like, in the marketplace. I think, like, just if people are going to flock to that, they're going to flock to that later. It's going to have to really be a slower build.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get that romantic comedy, breakout hit, especially when it's something this sort of quiet.
And specific, yeah.
Yeah.
Where you know, it is a romantic comedy, but it's also many other things. And the most interesting thing about it is that the romance is mostly off the screen.
Well, yeah. but it's honestly a romantic comedy that uses that mechanism to sort of advance the relationship of him with the parents, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's almost like, you know, that he's sort of courting them, which I find very, like, charming.
Very charming, and also, like, that's its, like, bid for, like, complete originality for a romantic comedy. Like, I realized watching it how little romantic comedies give you about sort of the texture of people's actual family lives.
Yeah.
And yet when you get together with someone, whenever you've had, like, a real relationship, you end up involved in their actual life, not just them.
Yeah.
Derek would agree with you.
I mean, unless they're completely estranged from their families, but it's still like, you know, it's that whole thing of when you marry someone, you're marrying their family.
Right.
Yeah.
Which romantic comedies never talk about.
Except for Meet the Parents, which was the cinematic achievement of our time.
Right.
Shall we all sing A Fool in Love together right now?
Although this had no jokes about breastfeeding.
They were implied.
So speaking of meeting your intended large and diverse family, War for the Planet of the Apes, is that a good segue?
Wow.
Imagine, just you meet a nice, you know, oh, he's a general in an army. Like, it's very nice. It's just like, oh, well, there's a whole thing.
And here's another movie I don't really know how to talk about without talking about the ending.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't seen it yet, but, like, feel free to spoil away, because I never remember about these movies after. No, my friend's in L.A., and I promised him that I wouldn't see it until he got back. So
okay.
He's been there for
a while. Well, this will be a vague spoiler.
I don't care.
But no, but unless you really understand what the series has been leading to, and it's basically like a prequel trilogy. So it's leading to the world where the apes really are in charge of everything and there barely are any humans, right? And you might say that we've been leading there for a really long time, and did we need three movies to get there when we'd already been there for six movies? But whatever. But to me, like the most like moving and sort of damning part of it is sort of the war between humans that has nothing to do with apes, which I found, and it's sort of like almost the sort of backdrop visuals to the finale that I found really, really depressing in a good way. Like sort of about like, wow, yeah, like about mankind's self-destructiveness, you know. What, as the apes just go off to do their own thing, which they wanted to do anyways, and people weren't letting them, you know.
So the humans are fighting amongst themselves as to what to do about the apes?
Well, they're just now they're just at war with themselves, basically. And so basically mankind has moved on from slaughtering apes to slaughtering each other, and so there's going to be none of them left, you know.
But which is something you only really know from some exposition at the beginning and from some events at the very, very end. And I can, that's right, Nathaniel, right? And I can totally see why the movie didn't want to be splitting itself among multiple threads where we're spending more time on that. And in a way, I liked the movie. Like other people, I think I was sometimes a little bit startled by its desire to be totally on the nose about some of its metaphors and allegories. And so by the time something that you've sort of forgotten about, like, crashes back into the movie, like I was really welcome to have a surprise element because it was all just feeling a little pre-plotted. But it is the I agree that it's one of the most interesting things going on, and it made me long to see a little bit more of it, I guess. But maybe that would have been hard for this movie to accommodate.
I mean, I did think it could have been tighter, but maybe that's just the effect of like three movies dealing with this, you know.
Watching the trailer, I was sort of struck by this thought that this Woody Harrelson character seems to be playing kind of exactly the same function that the Gary Oldman character played in the previous movie, and I was sort of wondering what's different about it this time. What's that he's sort of this like, military, maniacal madman bent on yada yada yada, like is there an appreciable difference between what he's doing in this and what Oldman was doing in the previous one?
That Woody Harrelson's a better actor? No, I'm just kidding. Whoa!
Than Gary Oldman? Wow.
Sorry, I'm not a fan of Gary Oldman in villain mode ever. I think he's a very good actor when he doesn't play villains.
Hot take. They did teach you how to do hot takes. That's great.
I always find him wildly over the top, even if that's the not the tone of the movie when he plays
For
villains.
sure.
I find that these movies operate as a Men in Black device, and even though I really liked Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, within 3 days I was like, did I wait, what's the movie I saw this week that I can't remember? And so what I remember about that one is Jason Clarke is super hot, and the movie was really good looking, and that I basically liked it. That's what I can tell you. Lots of leaves. A lot of tall trees. And I'd even forgotten about Monkeys on Horseback until this one. I was like, oh yeah, I've seen that before. But, and then I remembered about the COVID stuff. Whatever. Anyway, I don't remember a lot about that one. And so even, and actually none of them. I've only seen the 68 one and then these recent ones. But all of the ways in which this movie is kind of determinedly catching you back up to the original films, they are so never, ever, ever, ever on my mind, and when they are, I can barely remember them. So I wasn't even aware of that until I read reviews after I got home.
That it
Which
was
is.
basically a prequel trilogy, you mean?
So it connects to the original series of movies, like, concretely? Oh, wow. God, I never saw any of those movies. Is that weird? Like, I managed to grow up without seeing any of the Planet of the Apes
Oh, you
movies?
should really see the first one. Just because it's such a like a sci-fi like classic, so, like such a milestone in, you know, whether or not you think it's good, it's such like a event movie from the 60s.
Do I need to see
and it? I thought it was really good.
Yeah, I like it too. I like the first one a lot too.
So there are even some moments in this that, if you are remembering those clearly, are like blatant fan service. Like, let's name this girl.
Yes,
like, whatever.
Yes, exactly.
But
yeah.
I didn't even clock that until it hit me later.
Well, I have the complete box set of all of the Planet of the Apes movies, so I definitely clocked the fan service thing.
Got it.
So, but I also thought it was clunky. And, you know, full disclosure, I'm not really a fan of prequel trilogies.
What? You're kidding.
Just because, in general, I'm against backstory, because I think it makes movies less imaginative.
That makes sense.
I really preferred the days where fan fiction was fan fiction and not actual fiction.
Uh-huh.
Because I think that part should be for the audience to fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
Not that I have nothing against fan fiction, I think that's great. I just wish it would remain fan fiction.
Well, it's. I mean, and I like these movies too. The one with James Franco and Frida Pinto less so. But
yeah.
It's funny to me that anybody thought that there was a need for an explanation as to the Planet of the Apes. It's like, yeah, it's a planet. There's, you know, the apes are in charge. We can draw this line. Like, we, you know, we get it.
It's right there in the title, like snakes on a plane.
Well, once you get to the, oh, it's our planet. Oh, okay. Well, then that's what happened. I can assume. Yeah.
Which everybody knows, even if they haven't seen the movie. Okay,
yeah.
Great. Let's move on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, they didn't in 68, though, which is why it was such a...
Sure.
They didn't in 68, right.
Such a shock.
Yeah. No, my most familiarity with those movies was the scene in Spaceballs where they parody it at the end. That's basically the most that I've ever...
That's when I learned about it.
Yeah, that's funny.
Well, there is a great moment, which we can edit this part out. There's a great moment in the original that I had to GIF last time I watched it, where I have no idea why, but Charlton Heston and his two astronaut friends, they're all shirtless and wet, and for some reason the other two guys crouch down in the grass, but he remains standing, and it really, really looks like a scene from a porno where suddenly the guys go out of frame. So I had to GIF it.
This idea of Charlton Heston as like the Forrest Gump of homoeroticism, where just like he keeps like bumbling into these like hugely homoerotic setups and has no idea what's going on, and just sort of like passes through, it's like Ben Hur, do do do, and just sort of like walks through, and everybody else is sort of like staring at it and just being like, oh my god, it's so homoerotic, and he's like, don't know what you're talking about, yada yada yada.
Yeah, I love all the stories about Ben Hur, about the fact that William Wyler and Stephen Boyd managed to keep that from him, even though it's right there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when Kevin Spacey makes his Gore Vidal movie, we'll be hearing a whole lot more about that.
So I'm glad he can still lock down roles like Gore Vidal even without coming out of the closet, you know? Like,
I mean, isn't it a de facto coming out of the
closet?
I'm
worried that if he came out, it would really get in the way of the kinds of characters he plays.
Right? Right? like leering baby driver, you know, handler.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Baby driver handler.
And bisexual president, and, you know, so on and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Shit, Tony host. Whatever. About Planet of the Apes. Nathaniel, if one were being schematic about this podcast, I might say that it's sort of the opposite of The Big Sick insofar as it's, I thought, incredibly well made in terms of how it's shot and how scenes are structured and just how it looks. Like, mm-hmm. I thought there was a little too much music, but the music's really good. But doesn't have exactly what The Big Sick has, that, you know, moments that I still think about later, or you're like soliciting your own imaginative involvement. Like, that's kind of what I think these movies are still struggling to do a little bit. They're doing all this world building, but in this case, especially because it's so insistent on its Guantanamo resonance and its wall building resonance and stuff, it just, they feel like they're kind of doing all their own work for themselves. And even halfway through, once you get what this one is coded to be about, it just unfolds according to what starts to feel a bit like a recipe. I don't feel that way about, like, you know, Matt Reeves did Cloverfield, right?
Yes.
And that felt like it had so many openings for the audience to conjecture. And I think these are even stronger movies than that was, but I am hoping for his chops to eventually kind of accommodate us a little bit more.
Yeah.
But it's great looking.
100% agree on everything you just said. And that's what I'm talking about with the prequels and all that. It's like, I just need space for myself.
Yeah.
Which sounds very, I don't know, sounds very narcissistic, but I actually think it's, like, really true in general of audience members.
Yeah.
I just think people don't realize sometimes, maybe, that that's why they don't really get into something. It's because they don't find a way to be in it as themselves and still be a part of it, you know?
Yep. Yeah.
Your deep thoughts for the day.
Oh, I'm just getting started.
So, Baby Driver, speaking of Kevin Spacey a moment ago.
Yeah. I actually really liked Kevin Spacey in Baby Driver. I thought he was probably giving the second best performance in the movie.
I actually kind of, well, I shouldn't say love every performance. I'm a fan of the acting in general within the movie.
Yeah.
I think the tone, I think everybody really understood the movie they were making.
Yeah. I still continue to be very disappointed with every John Hamm film performance. I keep expecting something along the level of what he was giving in Mad Men, and he just consistently declines to give that to me, but...
Although, has he really had the opportunity?
I mean, in a movie like The Town, he was a co-lead, essentially. Like, he got a lot of opportunity in that, and sort of was very underwhelming, and I don't know. You're right in that he hasn't had a whole, like, you know, certainly he hasn't had a role that's as interesting as Dom Draper, but, like, you're never going to have that. You have to sort of, you know, until you become a giant, like, you know, have your pick of every script movie star, you're going to have to impress us with smaller things, and he really hasn't.
Yeah,
but
I can see that complaint
of John Hamm doubters. So,
I mean, I loved him in this, but I get what you're saying.
What did you love
about him?
Yeah,
I just, again, it's not anything specific other than I felt the actors really understood the tone. It's not that it's cartoonish, but it's sort of like, what's another word for cartoonish, but not quite there, like, it's illustrated.
Yeah.
there's something very sort of like broadly but sharply defined, like an ink drawing as opposed to like just a funny cartoon. Like, I think everybody's very like on point. But it is a very sort of limited concept of, like, character creation.
Yeah. I think it's a movie that sort of weaves in and out of its best self a lot, and when it's there, I'm really sort of on board with it. And despite the fact that I find the cult of Edgar Wright alienating, just sort of in and of itself, there are parts of the movie that really sort of brought me in. I think Ansel Elgort is actually fantastic in it. I think he's exactly what you were talking about in terms of just, like, being exactly what is required for him in this role. But also, like, I think he brings a good deal of personality to this very sort of, like, limited character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the early stuff in the movie with, you know, that first chase and, you know, even those first, like, couple meetings with the, you know, Kevin Spacey's little crime group or whatever. I think it's some good stuff. I think the movie for me kind of sort of keeps, you know, going around the same wheel and with diminishing returns. And then once we get into, like, having to care about this romance with the Lily James character, who is comedically thinly drawn. Like,
yeah.
There are a couple of points where I was just like, are we going to comment on this? Is this, like, a thing that's being done intentionally to, like, you know, serve some sort of greater irony about thinly drawn female characters? And it's like, nope, it's just, that's how we need to have her be for the rest of the movie to lay out the way it does. And then everything from that towards the end. So, like, I can't care about that kind of stuff. I can't care about whether he and this, you know, paper airplane of a woman, like, end up getting together. And
yeah, I mean, the that element of the movie was definitely, like, weak. And not just her, but the other female character, too, who basically served the same function only for John Hamm.
Yeah. I did find her fun. I liked that actor. I thought that actress sort of at least brings, like, there was a spark to her whenever she sort of even had, like, you know, little side things to say. But yeah, there's no well-drawn female character in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even by the limitations of how well the male characters are drawn.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Nick, what were your thoughts on this?
I thought it was, you know, the beginning's really fun, that whole first sequence.
Yeah.
And I'm not, like, an Edgar Wright partisan either. And I think it's specifically the kind of, I don't always think his ideas are as clever as people who like him, I guess, whatever. I don't react the same way. I don't. Mm-hmm. And then as the movie went on, it was just leaving a sour taste in my mouth. Like, I'd sort of assumed it was going to be at the level of its opening, and just be kind of surfacey and about colors and songs and whatever. But it just kept being harder for me to avoid that, like, Baby Driver is a shit person and is, like, totally a complicit henchman in all of this, despite the movie's desire to sort of sentimentalize him or make us root for him in some way. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, by the time he's, like, dropping his foster father off at the nursing home, I'm so sorry, I'm shitty, sorry, and has to go, like, yeah, you're shitty. And and it just felt like the movie was really interested in, like, having a good playlist and, like, style points as sort of, like, this was its version of Neo in a different way, right? Like, he just had all these skills or associations that the movie really loved. Mm-hmm. And then I was excited, we're spoiling again, but, like, as I was just having a harder time overlooking that there's literally no reason for either her or the audience to be behind this guy, then the police all show up. And it's like, oh, the movie does get it. And then they haul back their, three women characters and a black guy to on the stand to be like, no, but he doesn't deserve consequences, though. You should let him go. I'm like, really? Jesus. And then it just seemed in total crisis about knowing that it had, like, a bad character who shouldn't, like, get off the hook about anything. But the movie was so in love with him that it couldn't afford to do that. So it left me feeling spooked by the end.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I didn't think of it as, like, real, so to speak. So, like, the sort of crime without consequence element of it didn't really...
Except that they make him so concerned with not killing anybody.
That's true, yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, I think the movie is a little bit schizophrenic in that way, whereas I don't think we're supposed to... Like, we are supposed to be on board with him, and I think I am on board with the character. I feel like... I get what you're saying, Nick, but that to me feels almost like extra, like, sort of going outside the boundaries of the movie a little bit. But it's a complicated thing, and I think it's unnecessarily complicated because the movie doesn't really stay consistent on that point.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, even as any of its attempt to contextualize, like, his morality, like, the sad backstory or any of that didn't completely play for me. Like, I didn't really get anything from his mother, you know.
Right.
And I totally take your points, but I think it was because of the increasing backup of reasons that people were just totally drawn to him, like Kevin Spacey's having this long-standing relationship to him, which I know was just because he had skills that he needed and whatever, but... Yeah. Everybody who felt attached to him in whatever way, I couldn't work out that attachment. Mm. Then the movie kept thinking of ways to kind of make us feel sorry for him or endear us to him or watch him make sandwiches for an old guy. And it's like, well, none of this is interesting to me, but you really want me to like him. I get it.
Mm-hmm. I just don't see the line between this is a guy who we see doing things that mitigate his crimes, and then at the end being like, well, like, you know, I guess we're supposed to think he mitigated his crimes. And it's like, well, he did. Like, we saw that. And that's, you know, that's why it was there. But
what was your favorite of his skills that he had? Because Kevin Spacey's was clearly, like, his twink skills.
Oh, my God. That stuff was... I mean, we, you know, talking about Kevin Spacey sort of, like, coming out in dribs and drabs. I think I said the other day on Twitter, he's, like, coming out via trolling, where it's just... In this movie, he's, like, every once in a while, he'll sort of just, like, look at... Like, the fact that his name... The character's name is Baby, so it's just, like, Baby, like, I need you, and, like, whatever, and it's like, oh, my God. And then... There's the point at the end where he goes, where Baby's trying to get away with Lily James and whatever, and Spacey goes, I get it. He goes, I was in love once. And he just sort of, like, looks at him, and I was just like, yeah, you kind of still are. Like,
yeah. Well, yeah, and he's, yeah. Baby and Doctor, you know, Baby and Doc. I mean, it's just all sorts of weird stuff happening, but in a funny way. Yeah. Like, the names in the movie made me laugh. A lot. Like Buddy, and everybody had funny names to me.
Were you guys as into the music as I feel like we were supposed to be?
I enjoyed it, but I'm not really like a music person, so my reaction to it was like, oh, I really want Edgar Wright to do a musical. Because he really seems to think of, like, even his movies that, like Scott Pilgrim, for example.
Yeah.
He has such a, like, a sense of musicality to the way he asked people to edit and, you know, all that stuff. So, like, I would love it if he would try, like, a actual musical.
This particular playlist felt very self-consciously cool in a way where I was just like, I get that there are people who are going to eat this up, but they are far too cool for me, and just, I want dumb pop songs, and these are like, oh, it's just like, oh, you know, this, like, forgotten gem from the 70s or whatever, and it's just like, okay, like, go for it, I don't care.
Well, we have to wrap up, unfortunately we're out of time. So thanks, that's our thoughts on a bunch of movies: War for the Planet of the Apes, The Big Sick, Baby Driver. What else did we talk about?
That was it, I think.
Oh, okay.
That was like five thumbs up and one down, is that right?
For Baby Driver.
Well,
Baby Driver was the only thumbs down.
Yeah.
And from you, right?
By which I mean eight thumbs up and one down. Yeah. Okay.
And we will be back in the next installment with Dunkirk and Spider-Man.